So, thought we'd talk about water. Water, of course, at its highest use is T. First three letters of teaching. They don't really teach without it. Water in the Taoist tradition comes up time and time and time and time again. It seems to me that whatever particular thing I'm studying or reading about or researching or meditating with, when you go to look at it, the example will inevitably be water. Even before you've really gotten through the first layers of inscrutability, you kind of know, oh, there's going to be a water example. It might be steam, it might be an ice cube, it might be crying, it might be whatever it happens to be. So I thought, well, let me just kind of look at the whole of sort of water as this metaphor for emotions. So water is this ever-present, ever-familiar, and useful metaphor that runs thread-like through the sinewy history of Taoist teachings. It represents flow, mutability, and a harmonious relationship to bounds or other. So to me, water represents flow, even if that flow is constricted or held up, such as in ice or an eddy, something. It will ultimately flow. Mutability, right? We see this just very easily apprehended when we just consider the simple and familiar phases of water, whether they're, humidity, we'll be into that pretty soon here, whether it's the water that we're drinking from our cups now, whether it's the snow that we presume here in mid-April is done for the season. hopefully. So the flow of it is quite simple, but it also sort of represents really beautiful bounds. And I really think of water as best describing the edges of things, right? The edges of most everything outdoors are described by water in the morning, right? The edges of, especially the sharp edges of any particular charged emotional state, are also described by water, whether we hold it in or not. The metaphor that I think we'll probably be returning to, because I figured out this is something I could draw, was a river. So we'll probably be talking about the bounds and the banks and the edges of the river, right? So, which is either the edge of the water or the edge of the earth. And we'll kind of look at that. When water is running, it's called a river. It may be called a river. Of course, under the term river, we can have stream and rivulet and all the rest. I'll probably just keep saying river. When it doesn't run, it's called a pool. Or, of course, it may be called a pool. It may have a mud puddle. You can call it whatever you like, but I'll just stick with pool, I think. So the difference, though, really, is that a river is change. A pool doesn't represent change, although it may change. A river is movement. A river is change. A river is movement. That is a description of life, right? When we fail to see movement or change, which really two ways of saying the same thing, then we're seeing death. We're seeing stagnation. We're seeing the non-living, which would be represented by a pool, right? Could also be represented by me holding back the tears, right? That idea of that death of an expression, right? So that might be a small, less existential death, but something about me knows that's not the healthy response. It might be the one I fight for because it's embarrassing, it's awkward, it's shame-filled, blah, blah, blah. It's not the right place. I shouldn't do it here in the lectern. But I might cry now. But I recognize that that's not a healthy change. That doesn't represent immutability, and it doesn't represent this beautiful bounding between things. Represents some bound, but more like a wall, more like an artificially erected thing. Maybe because of my upbringing, my language, my culture, my society, my view of my role, my view of the place's role, right? So I know I'm not supposed to cry in the bookstore, but I can cry at church when I'm talking to the pastor or something like that. So the place that I'm in can really inform my ability to let that water be flowing. which is to say, be once again representing life rather than shifting towards a representation of death. A pool is not movement, it reflects movement, right? So I can see movement in it. If the wind moves, I can see that pretty easily across a pool, maybe not across a river. And I can mistake that for, oh, that pool is moving, there's an outflow. But really what the pool is doing very nicely is reflecting other movement, right? Even if it's me making faces in the pool, it readily reflects movement that isn't of itself. So to stay with the metaphor then, the pool, even though it is water, and water is this thing that has this mutability and flow, the pool version of it doesn't represent that, at least not adequately, certainly not as obviously as a river would. So a pool accepts change, but it does not represent it. A pool is a reservoir, a stockpiling of life, a hoarding of life and life-giving energies, right? So water, this flow, this movement, this representation of life, and indeed this key ingredient of life, well then a pool represents this stockpiling, this reservoir relationship to it, this hoarding of life. But if you're hoarding life, what are you hoarding it against? Looming death. I've brought the joy tonight. So this is a workshop on looming death. And let the tears flow. So this act of holding back the water is really this act of let me have, and the act of trying to have or contain or preserve is really this act in opposition to death or dissolution, right? Or end of life. So it's not really this pro-life action. It's born of an affinity for life. Like, I like this, I want more, and how do I not let the thing that isn't this happen? A reservoir, right? Or maybe it's a grain silo, or it's maybe I buy three of these shoes because I like them, so if I lose them or they wear out, I have the other two, right? That's not really sort of a, I don't know how I shifted into shoes. That's not, like, I don't know anything about shoes. But that's not really an act for shoe. It's an act against no shoes, right? And it's a born of an affinity for shoes, a relationship to them, right? So this pool idea is not kind of what we want to do. When we're practicing some of the many ways that we work on these, whether it's somebody on a table or taking some herbs or shifting their diet or doing a meditation, or you saw us earlier practicing some Tai Chi movements, I'm always looking for what's the river, not the pool, right? If you see a doctor in Chinese medicine of one type or another, and TCM is how I'll abbreviate that if that comes up, traditional Chinese medicine, you kind of can't get out of the office visit without hearing the term stagnation, you know. I joked with a Chinese doctor once, I said, the only way that you can leave here without mentioning stagnation is if I'm coming to pick you up for lunch. You know, if I'm coming here as a patient, something's stagnant. And guess what? We need a needle, we need herbs, we need a lifestyle change and all the rest, right? So, of course, the emotions that this talk is purportedly about, at the end we'll know what it had been about. I don't know what it's going to be. But the emotions are the water, right? And this is what I'm getting at. I like this analogy because scientists say that we're something, what is it, like 70% water, some kind of number like that, 75, so whatever. And on most days I'd agree that my makeup is 70% emotion, right? Not 70% expressed, right? But if I just witness myself, 70% of what's going on is emotional, right? With luck, some of the remaining 30% is thought, right? And with, you know, some real lustrous thought, maybe a small percentage of that is good thought, right? Really helpful and, you know, eureka type thought. But really sort of the bulk of my sort of human experience is emotional, right? Why I do what I do, why I don't do what I don't do, why I view what I view the way that I do, right? And it's true for you too. Now it sounds Seussian, so sorry about all the rhyme scheme there. So the point here then for me isn't to get people to admit that maybe 70% of us is made up of emotion, but just to give yourself a moment to look inside and does that feel right? The talk that I did last year sort of had me positing that the twin catalysts of any human action are hope and fear. Those are, if we really trace back the manifestations, we'll find one of those two at the root of what's happened in terms of my actions, including my views, my prejudices, my opinions, my insights, my inactions, and so forth. So the emotions, the river, maybe 70% just to pick that number, they flow through us and they change, both in their own expression of themselves, right? So what started out as resentment ripens as anger, right? So I wouldn't like to say, well, anger flowed through me. You know, we put something in this side of the factory and then it came out as this, and that's the thing that I got arrested for or yelled at or tail between my legs or had to go have a beer afterwards or whatever, you know, sort of my solution was to that. But I don't like to think of it as like anger came in and anger went out, although that's nice, it's sort of easy way to see it. But usually something comes in and it transforms within me and it comes out something else, perhaps notable, perhaps not. So that water, that inflow, that emotion comes in and transforms within me, but it also transforms me, right? So we know that if we come back at some point to this river and we take another aerial view, this river will have changed, right? This will have shifted slightly here, this will be a little thinner, not purely because the flow of water has changed and there's drought or not drought or anything, but literally this is changing the landscape, right? When it comes around here, this is going to be speeding up quite a bit. Can you see that? This pressure is going to change, right? So there's a fixed flow in the river, but a wider berth here than here. So we can see that this is going to begin to erode here on this side, and it'll begin to deposit on this lower bank, on this north bank here. And then eventually, perhaps we end up with an oxbow, and then we have it cut off, and we have an oxbow lake and another turn. So this is going to not only change as it moves, like the emotions that flow through us change, but they change what they flow through. That probably sounds crazily obvious, that they change us. But the reverse is true. This is a two-way street, right? I can dig this or put sandbags, or a beaver can change it and then change how the water flows too. So I can change what I'm doing. So there's this two-way street idea. I'll maybe use this here. So those of you guys that study with me before already know that I seem to love this diagram, perhaps because it's drawable by me. So this is a rather simplified Taoist worldview. We have heaven and we have earth. Right, so the first two, in fact, the number three in Chinese is this, right? The number one, we start with one of these, then we add the other, so now we have two, we have heaven and earth, and then we have the third, which is the middle H. If this is a class, I'd make you guess, and then make you feel bad if you guess it wrong. But heaven, earth, and what lies between is humanity, right? So this line is an expression of humanity for me. The sort of the actions of these two create the experience, expression, and action, in fact, the existence of the center. The Tao Te Ching, that great book, sort of the user manual for Taoism, we might say, or maybe we call it the non-user manual. That's probably better. Let's TM that, whoever's doing the audio video. So The non-user manual says in the beginning there was one, from one came two, from two came three. All right, that's really simply stated. And then it doesn't say from three came four. It says from three came the 10,000 things. So probably 7,612 wasn't such an important thing to put in the book. But 10,000 was, and 10,000 to the ancient Chinese meant all. It meant everything, right? But the first three, those are the key ones, right? If you really work hard to build a haiku, you really end up with the essence of what you're working on. If you just have 12 sheets of paper to write a poem, you'll probably have a lot more than just the essence, right? And you might have some florid language or some cool rhyme schemes or some interesting rhythm changes or whatever. But if you really work your creativity into this corner, if it comes out the other side as a poem, it's going to be the essence, right? And so when we end up in this piece of the Tao Te Ching with just these four things mentioned, you know, in the beginning was one, from one came two, from two came three, from three came the 10,000 things. I think of that as right. So the moment the two arrived, the three have arrived. It isn't that, oh, we're both here, who else is, she's late. It's not so much an actual other, but the very fact of two creates a third entity, a relationship. There is no relationship that is the sum of its parts. It's born of the sum of its parts, and it's this other thing. Does that make sense? Okay. So just for the gentleman, because I know the ladies got that already, the relationship is not just you plus her. It's something else. So you have three things to work on, gentlemen. Her, gently, us, and she's probably said this, and you. Okay, so there's a lot more there than just, oh, you and me. There's two of it, and that's the whole dynamic. The math is much more difficult. So these are represented, perhaps, by spirit, mind, body. In Chinese, this is probably less helpful now. This is heart-mind. So this energy, the central energy, which is to say the intermediary energy, right, is heart-mind. The term in Chinese, xin, heart-mind, is this representation. We see the term and we feel very strongly that it must be, oh, I know what heart is, I know what mind is, so it's, I guess, those two together. And that's kind of close, that's helpful, because from the Western ear and the Western mind, that seems like I'm working on it. But the reality here is that it isn't heart plus mind, because that presupposes there's a separation and a distinction, right? But we start with that presupposition. Those are two words, they two different places, etc. And so then I try and fix it and mash them together to understand the Chinese. But to be clear, the Chinese don't understand it as two things taken together. It's a quality, right? And Xin is also the residence of, it's the catalyst for your emotional state. The Xin is also the residence for the Shen, sort of the energies of the spirit in Chinese. So we might think those wouldn't be resident here, they'd be somewhere else, but there's kind of an interesting sort of map of the self. So these are also, since I said Shen, and I said essence earlier, I'm just writing these Chinese terms for the people that do Tai Chi to be silently to themselves. Yes, I learned this for a reason. It's just to make them feel good, because the Tai Chi people don't walk around feeling good about themselves, right? They walk around feeling like I'm helping other people feel good, but this is a hard way to make a living. So I'm just gonna write these Chinese terms just to help the Tai Chi people feel better about what it is we do for work. You're like, yes, oh, I know those terms. So this is that spirit level, right, which you wouldn't have been surprised since we had heaven up here. Jing, I mentioned essence earlier, right? So the essence, Jing is the essence sort of in a poetic sense, not just in a in a reductionist sense. Like, you know what I mean? If I boil everything out, I get the essence of whatever it is I was cooking. I don't quite mean in that sort of physical essence, but a little bit more poetically, I mean essence. And this is really kind of an energy that's found in the kidneys. It's an energy that's found in what's called the governing vessel, the meridian of energy in the body that kind of is a minister to many others. That energy runs from the kidneys, the source of the Jing, through a gate in the lower back, which is something that comes up if you study Tai Chi, and then it moves to the heart and it moves to the base of the head. So there's a very interesting sort of experience here. We're not going to get too deep into this. This will be something that gets done in a class or a workshop, so I certainly recommend you go study this. This is more an introduction. But the way that I think of this, if you study Chinese meditation, Chinese healing arts, Chinese movement, Chinese massage, you'll hear Jing Qi Shen quite a bit. What's important is, here anyway, is that these three are interrelated, but they're also full duplex. So the Jing communicates this way, and the Shen communicates this way. It's not just that the Western mindset say, oh, the spirit's on top, that probably controls that and that rules that, and this one just shuts them and does it. Like, that's kind of seems sense, because that one's on top and it sounds better, it's the spirit. But really, there's a communication both ways. The reason that I wanted to consider this this way is that what we can see is that we have in the middle, that's probably the worst color to have used, we can see that what's in the middle here is this intermediary between the others. One way that I like to consider this, and I'll put this on the other side of the river, is all right. And what I think of the heart mind, or indeed humanity, or indeed the us as the mediator between the two poles, right? And any communication between me and you goes through us, right? This is exactly why when you have a position of trust, right, there's certain rules about who can date who and that sort of thing, right? And we hear about that sort of thing in the news all the time. Because it could be like, well, they're both adults and she asked him this and then they did the thing and you're like, yeah, but you missed that any communication went through the us, which is the relationship. And he was the dean and she was the student or whatever the relationship was. And like, that's a really key thing to understand. It wasn't just this straight communication between two people that it appears to be. It must go through the relationship. Whether this is husband and wife, father and daughter, like a father can't talk to a daughter without father-daughter being in the middle, right? That is how the communication goes on. And unfortunately, it's a bit like a game of telephone. So we do have to attend to what's changed here as this went through. I know what I meant, but the us changed it and then you heard it and you're all the way over there. There's this between us, right? Never mind when it comes back and you have your response, right? So now we have this long game. So it's my argument, and this is based on my research and understanding. So I really like to get grumpy when people say love yourself, because I don't think it's the realm of love. I think that love is the highest relationship between self and other. Right? There is no way you can love yourself. There is an awareness of self. Right, and maybe opinions that float around that awareness. But there isn't truly love. Love is my best relationship, and this is the relationship level, my best relationship with other. Whatever that other is, it could be the romantic love, it could be these socks, it could be this lasagna. It doesn't really make it lasagna. I think I just ran the talk off the rails there, people. I just need a moment. Okay, so yeah, I don't need pasta anymore, so I just, oh, that's good. Anyway, so I think of love as not exactly reserved for, but it's only really possible to understand it as this highest form of relationship with other, right? But that's what this is too, Right? My highest way to relationship with another is to recognize that there's an us as well as the you. Right? My highest relationship, Earth's highest relationship to heaven, is through me, or us, or our species, or whatever it is, and vice versa. The body's best relationship, highest sort of functional utility with spirit is this, and this is the realm of our emotions, which is purportedly what the talk is about, right? So if these emotions become pools, and that was spirit. Right? I don't have the priestly collar or probably the proper whatever I'm supposed to have, so I probably don't really know what this is. But my bet is that as we head towards the looming for death, we're hoping this is a pit stop or this is on the other side of it. But if this gets taken off the table because we failed to have a relationship to it, then what are we hurtling towards? Because we're all hurtling. Period. We're all hurtling, right? Maybe slower, maybe faster. So for me, studying Tai Chi meditation, all this kind of stuff, like I'm working on this level of relationship, right? Which is my essence relating to my spirit, right? Which of course, whatever I learn there can be tools that I use here and use here. So for me, love, like not unlike most people, I imagine, is this, you know, this thing. It's super especially important. And I really don't want it to get misconstrued or misunderstood or misappropriated, where people say, oh, it's first important to love yourself and then you can. No, it's not a function of my looking inward to love, right? It's a function of my unlocking the doors from inward, letting the flow flow. In relation to other. And any relation to other, of course, is at least one other. Does that kind of make sense? Right? So that's an easy one to have arguments about, because it sounds so good to say, love yourself first, and then you can care for other people. Love yourself first, and then you'll see what the truth is in somebody else's pain. All that, it sounds really good. But I really do think that it's a steer in the train of wisdom right off. I don't know if you steer a train off the rails, but anyway, like my grammar, it's just like steering the train off the penguin that's missing lasagna. So you guys know what I mean, right? Good. So, okay, so we're getting into it. So to begin to recognize this level of emotion, I think it's really important to see if you can have the least charged scenario to recognize it, right? So for example, if you're learning to have a helpful and constructive argument with somebody about something, right? Like, I have my view, you have your view, they're a little bit at odds, but I also don't fully understand yours, and I would like to sort of sharpen my expression of my own, and we each come to some understanding, if not persuasion. Right? If either of us mentions Hitler, there's no more argument. Because we just can't, you can't say, but Hitler, well, I have nothing else to say. Because it's such an extreme example, it doesn't really help us have an argument, a constructive argument. I don't mean two people just being angry, right? So that's a very charged thing to bring into a conversation. And people do that sort of thing all the time, right? From that emotional place, what I like to do is come into the place of the emotion, so the river bed, when it's not at flood, right? So all the things I may mention here in terms of things to do and techniques and all the rest, they could work in an argument with Hitler. They could work the day after you had your heart broken, but that's probably a particularly tough time to try it, and it's not fair to the practice, it's not fair to you. So what I like to do is regularly find a time to enter into the environment of flow when it's out of rainy season, right? So this may be after you've had a meal, after you've sort of had your leisure daydream time and you brought yourself somewhere else, you read a book, watched a movie or something, maybe that's the wrong time for you, I don't know. It may be right when you rise. It may be, for me, it's after I do standing meditation. I'll do my standing meditation, and then, and I know you guys will find this hard to believe, but then I'm empty up here. So things aren't charged. And then I can walk that riverbed, right? So some years ago, I was part of this retreat called Tai Chi Alchemy out in Sedona, Arizona. We did this every year. It still goes on, so I encourage you to go. TaiChiAlchemy.com. And at one point, we're going to walk through the, let's say, 110 degree heat, through the, I don't know what the term would be, the national park, the wilderness, the whatever it is. And find a place to practice. And that might be watching that snake or sitting on that rock or doing a little meditation or writing in a journal or soaking in the sun or playing poetry back and forth with people, going for whatever sort of you're settled in for after we've done our workshops, right? Or the first half of the workshop. So we'd go to this place. And I had walked for a bit and I came upon my colleague, friend, and teacher, Don Miller, who's this, you know, shamanistic Tai Chi guy. And he was in this dry riverbed. And I kind of brought across my path, and he had just kind of gotten there, and he was ready to settle into some kind of practice. And I don't think we talked too much, at least the way I remember the story, and I just sort of settled into practice with him. And the two of us had the most extraordinary experience practicing. And what we were practicing is we were practicing our sort of water-related energetic expressions from our own studies, right? So if this was a Tai Chi group, I'd show you what those moves looks like, but it doesn't really matter. Just imagine they were water, whatever, your mind is fine. So we started practicing this. So we're in Sedona. We've been there for a few days. There's zero humidity. It's 100-something degrees. Everything is parched and dying. You know, like everything is, like the bits of tinder from some, you know, tree somewhere were drier than the rocks, you know. And we're in this riverbed. It's very clearly a riverbed, right? But maybe every 2 years there's flowing water on it, right? So we practiced there for a little bit, and I can tell you that I learned more about water than I did growing up on the ocean or learning to row or going to the pond every day to practice or going to the waterfall in that retreat. I learned more about water in this sort of no water place, right? And so anyway, thank Don for that, and we both had this experience where, man, like, you can't believe that there's so much to learn about water. Because one can know, maybe even best know, water in a drought, right? In the same way that you can best know value in poverty, right? Rich people have a harder time in many cases understanding value. Do you know what I mean? But that poor lady, well, she gets it. Right? And why does she get it? Because she's not without rich. She's on the other end of a spectrum of the same thing, right? Drought is not water. It's a low degree of water. In other words, it's a measurement of the same thing. So drought and floodwaters are the same thing. It's just amounts. And that's very important if you have cattle and all, of course. But they're not two different things. That makes sense? So similarly, health and suffering, right? You can learn an awful lot about health and suffering. So when I try and get into this place where I want to have this non-charged expression, I try to go to a place where I'm not particularly emotionally involved. I'm emotionally available, but there's nothing charged. I'm not worked up. I don't have this little angsty thing because that phone call I didn't make still kind of caught on me a little bit. I try and get to that relatively drought place so I can recognize the contours of the stream. Okay? To know your waters, your emotions, of course, it can help to regularly discover, connect with, and settle into your flowless dry riverbed, right? So I make a recommendation of developing a practice. That was a scary word, and I apologize. But I use the P word. Developing a practice in which you can regularly enter into that relatively flowless, relatively dry stream bed of emotion, right? And the practice may be momentary. It may be 15 seconds. It may be 2 minutes. It may be 3 times a week. It'd be nice if it was every day, of course. And it'd also be nice if you had the Dalai Lama call you to say, practice now. Thanks, buddy. Like, of course, that would be nice, right? But we have the lives that we have. So if you can make a practice to enter into that, you can learn more about emotions in that drought state of emotions, or relatively, right? At least relatively, not deeply charged. So to do this, what I want to do is clear the heart mind of the emotions that are there. I'm not doing this when they're charged or particularly charged, right? So if your dog just died this morning, not the best time to, like, you're probably going to be charged about anything. So maybe that's not when you do it. But the other times, you're not a perfect monk. There are still little things going on, this little prejudice, this little angst, this little anxiety, this little worry, that little excitement. So there's sort of these minor charges. So that's when you can practice. So to clear the heart mind of emotions, I'm reminded of a story, a water story, because it's a Taoist story. The way that my teacher taught this, I don't know if the camera will get this, but see if we fake him out. But he took his glass of water. He had a little mug of water, and he said, okay, settle down, quiet. You good? Relax. Oh, that's good. Almost clear. Good? You got it? This is going to be nice. And that was his whole lesson. And of course, we understood, because we were brilliant students, allow me to rewrite history, that this was the mind. And there's no action that you can give to the mind that serves to clear it. There is, however, there's patience. And when I go back, that will have settled out, right? Not just without me doing anything, but because I didn't do anything, right? So the thing that I did was stop doing, right? Which means just before that, I have to convince my ego that I'm not buying anything it's selling, right? In order for me to stop my sort of paternalistic experience with manipulating the world, I have to tell my ego, I know you're going to ask me to do something, no thanks. I'm just going to be patient. And then I'll come back and the mind is settled out. So as part of this sort of regular revisiting of the riverbed heart, right, I want to let the mud settle in the cup, right? So again, this isn't a story of how to make perfectly distilled water or what if you don't have enough time for it to settle out. The point is, any patience is some settling. And if we already started without the most charged example, then we're on the right track. So as we do this regularly, this can become very important. The next step, so that's step one. Step two is anchor to the now. Anchoring to the now is to be only and fully aware of your place, space, self in that place, space. So I say to be only and fully aware, but as with anything I'm teaching, the only for now might be mostly. The fully for now might be getting there. So Again, it would be great if the Dalai Lama calls you, hey, I'm sending over pizza if you're doing meditation. Man, you're the best. That would be great. So I'm saying it as if it's the best. Be only and fully aware. But it might not be quite only or fully. But if we're setting our course, then we're on, and then we're on the way. So to anchor to the now is to be only and fully aware of your place in space and yourself in this place in space. Without, and here's the tough part, without attaching to your intentions as they arise. Right? That doesn't mean the intentions arise and become fruit, right? It's don't attach to them. So if I'm meditating, and this is particularly tough if I'm in a class, because you guys probably had this experience too, every time you're in a meditation class, everybody else is better than you. Is that right? It's weird how that works, right? But everybody that I know in a meditation scenario realizes invariably that everybody else is doing it right and better. Of course, that mathematically can't be true, but it's still true. If I'm meditating and I notice, boy, they haven't shifted at all in their seats, and that smile seems genuine, and I just, you know what, I just, right, I have to, and of course, that's wrong, and my parents didn't raise me that way, and I'm the worst student ever, and they're probably going to ask me not to come back. So all these kind of things can happen, but that's me attaching to them. If that's it, it's over. The event, the intention happened, relatively subconscious, and it even led, it fruited, it even led to an action. But I didn't get stuck on it. It passed. Just like in a lot of meditations, you want to let the thought pass, right? So it isn't about zeroing out the thoughts, although that is nice. It's about not attaching to the tensions as they arise, right? Because what happens when the mind attaches to something? Notice that it's the mind is not its own thing, right? So you don't just notice, wow, I'm not as good a student as the other people. That comes out charged. Oh man, they're so much better than me. I don't even know why they let me in this class. I am a worthless case of, you know. Like the mental part arrives with the emotional part. This is a thing, right? So I don't want to attach to them, not because I might not have a name for it, but because I can't name things without having opinions of those names. Right? If I was introduced as Beauregard, you guys would have an opinion about that name. Right? You know, it's like you can't help it. Right? That's usually when I go to Starbucks, I say Beauregard or Petunia, and just so they'll write it on the cup and say it. It's just a little bit of extra fun. Like, why not? They don't want to say Tim again. Like, the 50th. And Lisa, you know, like, it's not. Clearing the heart, mind of emotions, the mud in the cup, right? Or the mud in the pond or whatever, right? Anchor to the now, right? Without attaching to the intentions as they arise. Third, be story free. Right? You are not who you say you are to other people. You don't have to admit it, but we know it's true. Right? Everybody presents themselves in a resume-like fashion, to some degree, all the time. Sometimes it's hopeful, sometimes it's a little dishonest kind of on purpose, sometimes it's just shaded, sometimes it's more silver lining-y, right? Sometimes it's charged and you sort of say all the bad things, or it comes out as false humility or something because that's how you're feeling. But that isn't who you are, right? You are one who tells stories. And one who accepts stories, because we accept the stories we're told, right? And if we accept the stories that we're told, right, I don't even get to this. I get stuck here, and then I'm this false idea of what the actual you is, right? And since this is comprised, right, of you plus me, any failure to apprehend you, especially through story, means I don't get us, right? Which means not a healthy relationship, right? And we all know after the first two or three loves of our lives, right? Then we get down to, look, I don't care if you like to water ski and I don't know how to swim. I don't care if you're not the sexiest I've ever been with. Those aren't what's important. Here's what's important. We're always truthful to each other. We don't lie to each other. And you can tell me anything, right? That's what becomes important, some version of that. The earlier ones, I'm not even talking to you if you don't water ski, right? I'm sorry, I like somebody that, you know, has their long hair, so we're not, don't even ask me out. Like, we have these sort of simplistic ways of doing it. But then we arrive at, through some series of broken hearts, this idea like, look, honesty is important, right? And I want to feel like I can be myself with you. I want to feel like you tell me anything, right? But when we arrive at that point, we arrive at that point with a real yearning for it and no practice at it. So I suddenly know what I want and I'm even game to say it or demand it or remind somebody of it, but have I practiced it? Have I actually practiced not telling my story, not buying your story, right? And story really is plural. I'm trying to simplify. So to know this flowless dry riverbed is to clear the mind of emotions, the settling, right? And remember that I didn't draw the pool, you know, whatever the pool looks like, right? And put a little tree on it or something. So, you know, the pool is where things settle out, right? Water in a pool, but a river is where things deposit, right? So this is a flow of sediment, right? So if this is constantly bringing from upstream more sediment, more things to settle out, it really behooves me to have a regular practice with letting that settle, to find the low times, the uncharged times to let that settle, to anchor in the present moment, to be story free, okay? Ultimately then, what I'm asking you to do to get to this flowless dry riverbed, this state of relatively clear emotionless, which sounds odd, but lesser emotions and certainly less charged and no very charged emotions, to get to this state is to clear the heart, mind of the emotions, to anchor to the now, to be story free, such as you're able, and to have a flowering of sense, right? Like awareness. So the way I think of this is sense, not just hearing, not just vision, but whatever, just sense, right? Sense is of the now, right? So the way I think of this is sense, not nonsense, right? I want to be listening, right? In Tai Chi, the term is Tingjin. We talk about this expressed energy of participatory listening, gentle listening, such that I don't change what I hear through my act of listening, right? So to get into this state, then for me is to be listening, aware, without nonsense, right? Because this will say, oh, we're going outside. It's like having two dogs and you say to one dog, you wanna go outside? They both end up at the door, right? So when I say to my body, just be aware, just tune in, just listen, this shows up. What are we gonna do? What's the name of this? Should I get my notebook? I wanna write it out? Here's my opinion, right? And what I'm trying to do is not have that be involved, just to be aware, right? So when I get all these, then I arrive at that sort of dry riverbed and I can really map out this territory. Okay, a few more things. I'm tempted to put it out for questions now, but I want to say a few more things. Your mood is your choice. There is no possibility that a mood is something that is anything but your choice. It may be, of course, a subconscious or non-conscious choice, but it remains nevertheless a choice. Your mood is not the rain about which you have no control and which does in fact happen to, though not towards, you from an external place. The rain happens to you from an external place, not towards you, right? It's not directed at you, but it does happen to you from externally. You can do nothing about the rain. You can do something about your reaction to the rain, go inside, umbrella, curse it, whatever you want to do, but you can't make it rain, make it not rain, make it rain harder. Like, it rains when it rains. It's a purely external experience, right? But our moods feel the same way. Our moods feel like, oh, now I'm angry. Now I'm excited. Now I'm anxious. Now I'm worried. It feels like this thing that's happening to me, like a storm cell that's arrived, right? To get a handle on it, I believe, the sort of the Taoist sort of point of view here, that is my understanding, is that it can't be readily responded to unless you recognize it's always a choice. Perhaps subconscious, perhaps non-conscious, right? And I don't mean that when you've made the choice you meant to or you couldn't have made it. I just mean it has to have been a choice. Your mood may feel as though it comes from elsewhere and hits you, but it does not. It is a choice you make, though perhaps unaware. As far as proffering a reaction to events and catalysts, with training, practice, and a keen sense of what I said, the Tingjin, one may transform one's reactions into responses. My nutshell, Buddhism of late, which is, I guess there's a lot to it, but my little sort of haiku, if you will, my distillation of the whole of it is that it's teaching, respond rather than react. That's it. So like, as I review it, I look at it through that lens and I think, oh, I don't think that misses any part of Buddhism. Like, that covers the whole thing, right? The emotions you experience do not happen to you. They are also not yours, right? This is not my anger. This is not my happiness, this is not my whatever, the, you know, guilt, anxiety, whatever it happens to be. The riverbed doesn't have the river water. It is where it happens, it is how it happens, its shape, its state influence its flow. It is a conduit, an influencing pathway of the waters. It may cause the river waters to stagnate, slow, hurry, erode the banks, splash, etc. But the waters are not owned by the riverbank. That is not your anger. That is not your guilt. That is something flowing from headwaters to delta through you. You are a conduit like the riverbed for something that is life, that is flowing through you. Right? And that thing is a intermediary between the two poles, the yin and the yang, the him and the her, the heaven and the earth, the essence and the spirit, whichever sort of version of these kind of kicks in for you. So when I do this in private lessons all the time, somebody will say, oh, we're going to come in and we're going to work on move whatever because we worked on this one last week. And then, so how's it going? Well, you know, my boss said something. Oh, let's sit down. Yeah, so what happened? Well, he got me pissed off. No, he couldn't have. Well, I am pissed off though. No, no, you're not. Pissed offness is running, right? And then the question is, do you have blockages and stagnations where when it runs, it gets caught up? Right, and begins to foretell the looming doom that we talked about. So not only does the catching up here allow that sediment to pile up, but it also prevents whatever else might have been flowing downstream, right? Maybe joy or something that you might have preferred, right? Because this got caught up. It must flow through. And in flowing through, it can change you and it can transform itself, right? So part of what the title of the talk was Transcending Emotions, whatever my alliterative title was, it ended with Transcend Emotions. And part of it is about this idea of recognizing this thing is a thing that I've chosen to express, right? Maybe even for good reason. But it also isn't me. I am not the river, I'm the riverbed. I am shaped by the river, but I can shape and influence the river as well. Okay? When I think of all this, most of the things that I do are these movement arts where somebody says, you have tinnitus, so we're going to do this exercise. I have menstrual cramps, we're going to do this massage and type of movement. I have this, so we're going to do this stance and then breathe this way. And like, it's all these, here's what we're going to do. And then, they're always, by the way, and you should know this about your Tai Chi teachers, they're always a little bit more complicated than they need to be. Because if it was really easy to teach, you wouldn't keep coming back. So, like, to keep that in mind. Even if you get it sort of poorly, kind of halfway, the stuff is starting to work. Of course, we want to do it better, more easily, more gently. So, yeah, you know, keep studying, get more and more, whether it's Qigong or Tai Chi. But if you're starting to do the movement, you know, the shape of the riverbed is changing. I'm learning to shift the course of these rivers so that they don't get caught up, so that I don't get my banks eroded by them, my edges, my bounds, myself, right? Because if myself gets eroded and I lose my own bounds, then that is half of what makes up us, right? So I can't say, well, honey, this isn't affecting us. It's just me having this weird, tough time. Because if this is being eroded, this is not the same constituent parts, right? And this is the intermediary of my connection, energetic transformation from one to the other, or communication from one to the other. So everything shifts if the riverbed shifts. So in Tai Chi, we have a term called Wu Wei. So Wu Wei, often translated as not doing, which for some of us that work for a living, that sounds really awesome. I want to learn about that. But I don't like that translation. To me, what Wu Wei is something that fits here. It's the best version of a relationship between one thing and another. The way I like to think of it is, the translation that I use for it now is swimming with the flow. Right? A lot of people sort of mischaracterize the idea of Wu Wei, and it sounds like a teenager. Just, oh, you were on the couch when I left for work. Have you? Oh, okay. I guess you'll be there tomorrow, right? I asked you to take the trash out one thing all week. I guess the couch looks nice, right? And it has this sort of feeling of not doing, right? But the Taoist idea of Wu Wei, which is a real integral idea to sort of much in Chinese medicine, but certainly in Chinese meditation and Tai Chi, that sort of stuff that I do, is accomplishing through that. And so once I put the word accomplish, we know we're not talking about the teenager anymore. So that's the wrong way to understand it. So swimming with the flow to me is sort of this question of how harmonious can your relationship to flow be in the context of pursuing your path? So again, how harmonious can your relationship be to the relationship to the flow? How harmonious can your relationship to the flow be in the context of pursuing your path? Swim with the flow does not mean bob and float downstream utterly at the mercy of the currents. Right? That's the teenager on the couch. So to me what it means is if, I guess I stick with the blue, but if this is the direction of the flow of energy and I wanted to swim from point A to point B, I should not just swim like this, right? what we all know, this kind of, you figure it out pretty quickly, you head over here because the flow will push you and you'll end up over here. But that's still swimming against the flow, right? Wu Wei would be to walk over here and get in and just head slightly left as you go downstream. Or when you're over here, you say, you know what, I'll just get out over here somewhere and I'll walk back. Or I'll realize B is the same as C, they're the same, like I didn't really need to, I just had that in my head, right? So swimming with the flow to me is pursuing that path, right? And I don't use the term goal, and you could see that right away. As soon as I put goals up, I changed them, close enough, good enough, what's the point? But it's how do I swim with the current, with the flow that is there, in a way that there's a harmonious balance of what I'm headed for, which I do want to get over on the river, and this is technically the other side of the river, but I was kind of headed over on, around that elbow, and then the current, which is doing its own thing, right? So I don't ignore the current, and I don't fight the current. I work with what the flow is, while headed in the direction that I'm headed. And that's Wu Wei. So that's why I think of it as swimming with the flow. Sometimes people will say, well, Wu Wei isn't not doing, because that's often translated that way, it's going with the flow, right? But going with the flow is cannonball into the river and you end up where you end up, right? The leaf is going with the flow that falls in the river and goes down. But that's not about path and practice and process. Right? That's non-sentient, right? That's not a story of a nervous system relating to how things are. Wu Wei is a story of a nervous system relating to how things are. Does that kind of make sense? So in order to do that, we do need to have some sense of listening, right? So again, just Tai Chi terminology of listening. You know, because if that river was going the other way, or there was rapids here, or there was fishing line here and I didn't notice it, or I still had my cell phone and wallet in my pocket and now I'm going to cross the river, like, so I want to listen to the place and the space, right? How what's going on here, and how am I going to head in the direction of my goals in keeping with what is actually happening, particularly the flow. The flow, of course, is the life. So I'm talking about this to sort of readily recognize it as this externality, this river, my body swimming across. But of course, this is the emotions flowing through your life, right? And how do you head where you're heading, bearing in mind what that flow of emotions is, right? That flow of emotions is necessarily going through you. That's what it means to be a person. So one of the really interesting things about water, and this is a real sort of a recurring theme in Taoism, is that water takes the shape of whatever is its container. Right? I can't pour water into glass and have all the water here. It fills the container. And even if it's this weird hand-blown glass, oddly shaped, whatever, if you put water in, it, the way they usually say it in Chinese is it becomes the glass. Right? It takes the shape of that container, right? And so for me, one of the first things that happened to me in clinical practice in China was the fellow came in, and the doctor I was working with said, you know, we're going to treat this guy. And the guy came in kind of sort of something along these lines, you know, right? And then the practice was like, clearly, you know, we don't have to do a big intake here. This is somebody that's depressed, introverted, anxious, you know, glum, right? And so the practice is like, put the two hands on the shoulder and here. So then the person was like, God. And then, so how are you feeling? I can't really say sad and depressed. I mean, yes. My wife left me yesterday, the dog died this morning. Like those things, those events still happen, right? There is still something working its way down the river, but it's not getting caught in me, right? I'm not denying it happened. I'm not pretending it didn't happen. I'm just going to the movies and getting drunk or whatever you might do. But I'm shaping the riverbed to help that flow go through, right? So if next time you're happy, delighted, overjoyed, like this may happen this time of year when the, you know, the tulips start coming up or something, you have that kind of thing, try doing this. And like, you can't express the same, and you won't want to do this for long, but just to, you already know it's true, right? But to actually just feel it, try, this is not what, and when you remember this and you see whatever it is, something this time of year, the first time you see the baby robins or something like that, you'll, if you remember what I'm saying, you're like, I think it was more or less cross the arm, look down, don't lift the corners of your, maybe cross your legs. But you'll find that if you do this, just before you did it, you'll have been like this. Like, you won't be like this. I think he said cross the arms when you see the baby robins. And then you'll already have your heart open, right? You'll already be looking at the horizon, not the floor, right? And so I'm reshaping the riverbed of the self, right? I had a teacher that said, in no uncertain terms, do not play music during class. Right? Because you'll be influenced by the emotions that are not yours. Right? Because you're in whatever mood you're in, but that happens to be sad or happy music or fast music or whatever it is. And I said, in no uncertain terms, I'm not here to learn about your opinions. I'm here to learn Tai Chi. I'm going to be playing music. Well, this is the same reason that I went to acting school. It's one of the things I studied. For me, I kind of looked at the life ahead of me, right, sort of downstream, if you will, although it was uphill at that point, which doesn't make any sense. But I looked at the life ahead of me and I thought, well, I'm only going to have so many dogs die. I'm only going to fall in love so many times. I'm only going to have so many new cars or new vistas. It's just going to be what it is. And I thought, boy, if I can inhabit other experiences as play, I would really enjoy exercising that thing I'm capable of as a human without having come to those catalysts honestly. Do you know what I mean? So I probably will never have AIDS, right? But I can play some character that has to wrestle with that and then tell their lover this and whatever happens in that play. And so for me, like a real big part of why I studied acting was like I wanted to practice and play at the different types of rivers that are possible to flow through me. For just this 6-week run, that's all I can do because I also have my own life. But it's the same reason I want to play different music. I want to have that thing come through me. I want to feel what the spring rain feels like coming down that riverbed. I want to feel like what it feels like to have this flow through. Right? I have plenty of my own when this or the other catalyst happens, but I want to play at that practice. I want to have those experiences. You know, so for me, this, right, humanity here, this is what makes us what we are. We are conduits for a river of emotions. Right? And I know that sometimes it's a drought, sometimes it's flood water, sometimes it's water, but it's not potable. Sometimes it's rapids, etc. I understand that. But it's important to keep it flowing. It's important to recognize that those emotions are not you and they are not yours. They shape you, you shape them. They change you and they change themselves as they pass through. Last thing I want to say about this. This is really, really key. Emotions don't go anywhere unless they are expressed, right? This is a description of something being expressed, maybe transforming and then transmitting when it goes out to the next person or whatever it is, your cat that you're petting, it doesn't matter. The emotion has to be expressed. We instinctively know this is true, and we also know, although we may not admit, that we don't practice this all that much. An emotion that goes unexpressed is a pool. It's a stagnation, and that is not healthy. That's practicing death. It's practicing non-movement, blocking, stillness. It's practicing diminishing the flow that is coming because you're still technically alive. So there is something in the headwaters headed your way. Okay? So the emotions must be expressed. Doesn't mean that the moment that I, you know, feel like laughing, I realize where I am and say, maybe this is not the exact perfect moment. It doesn't mean I have to express it at that moment or to that volume or degree or to that person or whatever. So in expressing emotions, which should be practiced along with everything else I'm suggesting, the emotions must be practiced at least not destructively. So this is like the Hippocratic idea, at least not destructively. Once you can assure yourself that you will not be expressing your emotion destructively, which is really to say, to have a really deep relationship with other, right? To consider them, not just where it leaves you, but to have the relationship with other. Then it becomes your path and your practice to express emotions constructively. So we start with, let me not do any harm with the expression of the emotion, which must be expressed. But then I want to graduate to, how do I constructively express what's coming down from upstream? Okay, and that's the practice. If there's an easy way to tell you how to do it, I just read you a thing and you do it. But my students know that any question they ask, I will just say the answer is practice. Steve, I wonder, practice. I didn't hear the question. I know, but that's the answer. You want to finish, if you feel better finishing the question, you can say it. But really, the answer is practice. So I think we'll take it to questions. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You said that the first stage of dealing with emotion is allowing it to settle, correct?
Okay, yeah.
What do you recommend person do during that time? Is distraction then appropriate while you're letting that emotion settle?
Yeah, is distraction appropriate? Yeah. So distraction to me is taking the mind out of the presence in which the body must exist, right? So any distraction, I feel it can't be part of the correct answer. It feels easy though, right? You know, like I have a friend of mine who does this Qigong, and he says it's working for him. And he says, well, I just put on the whatever half hour program I DVR'd and then I do the Qigong. And he looks at me and I'm like, and he's like, yeah, but it's work. And I'm like, I know, because even when you're not doing it that well, the stuff, like I said before, kind of, there's something there. But I don't think distraction is a part of any truly wise answer. Do you know what I mean? It's compelling, right? But any distraction is a non-presence. It's inauthentic, and it fails to allow you to fully apprehend your present state and moment. Do you see what I mean? So if you can have your body relatively still, this may be sitting, it may be standing, or if you can have your body doing something that's relatively rhythmic, which there's a stillness to a repeating pattern that the brain can sort of exult in, then you can start to shift into that, finding that flowless riverbed that we were talking about, right? Yeah, so she said some kind of repetitive movement may do that. So it's not, you notice that wasn't my first suggestion, but that may be the path to getting to something. But the key then would be not to be daydreaming, or be, if your mind is in a place other than where your body is, it's distraction. Do you see what I mean? So it's very easy, like, oh, I'll just pull weeds and I'll do it for, I'm going to be on my knees for a half hour doing this. But then probably you're not really pulling weeds for a half hour, apart from physically. You're, oh, I wanted to get oranges for the thing I'm making on Saturday. Oh, I need to call Fred back. Like, you're probably other than pulling weeds, right?
So you were saying earlier about letting the mind settle. You can't constantly flick the cup or it never calms down. And you're talking about, I like the bare riverbed idea, but the things that sit on the riverbed, whether it's a fallen tree trunk or a rock or whatever, you know, that affects the flow of the water. And you mentioned obstacles. How do you distinguish between the things you need to simply let settle and the obstacles that need to be removed? And you know, how do you know that the tree, the fallen tree, isn't really benefiting you in some way?
Uh-huh.
So where does that come in?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that the tree would be benefiting you in some way, but it is true that you can derive benefit from whatever the condition, right? So I like to start with, I probably can't build a better river than happens. So if my first inclination is to tinker and fix, that's probably what I want to proscribe. Do you know what I mean? The prescription generally will be patience and attention, right? And then when you really truly have ascertained, here's what's going on, here's how this works, then you can play. You know, probably not in a charged situation, right? But like, hey, what does happen if I move that? Maybe I'll consider doing this. But I know that even though I simplify the analogy, there's no way I can build a river as good as nature does. Even though in my mind, I guess you just get a steam shovel and you just turn the tap and it probably, but probably a million things go wrong at least, right? So I wouldn't want to approach, let's say, that log or that you know, something there and approach it just is my first opinion that I don't like it, right? Or that feels off, and like examine where did that feeling come from, right? If it's a Budweiser can floating down there, it's an easier call. Like, oh, that just doesn't belong there. Like that's, right? So if it's a prejudice installed by your parents floating down, you're like, oh, that didn't naturally show up. That was given to me unhelpfully. Maybe I do want to fish that one out, right? But generally, if it's a natural occurring phenomena, try and be patient and trust that you can at least derive something healthy from it, learning, creative, healing, with patience and attention. And then in time, when you get more comfortable in a non-charged situation, you can tinker, you can play a little bit, right? That help?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're not a fan of the concept of self-love. If you're working with somebody who, like, had alcoholic or addicted parents and they don't have a clue what unconditional love is, they don't know, they don't have any self-esteem, they don't,
sure.
What are you going to teach them if you're not going to teach them self-love?
Well, I'm going to teach them the same thing I teach everybody else. So what they're, the beautiful situation that they find themselves is that they have a name and a clear understanding of the situation. The regular people that are just want to learn a few movements think they have all that stuff figured out, the parents and the self-love and all that kind of stuff. Somebody that comes that kind of broken, it's actually much easier in many ways because they have a name for it, they believe it. It's very hard to argue that things are right and normal and usual for them, so they're open to that. I don't feel like the teaching and addressing of the human condition, for me, from the teacher to the student, is going to vary much from student to student, regardless of the conditions. Because the conditions are an overlay of the actual humanity. And the actual humanity doesn't change.